This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day.
Hi, I'm McKenna Dowdle, and I work for Visit Lubbock on the marketing team.
Hi, I'm Lacey Freeland, and I work for Visit Lubbock, and I manage the social media for Visit Lubbock.
So here we are in Lubbock in the high plains of Texas, in an area that a lot of people might not properly visualize. 90 minutes to New Mexico?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating.
Yeah,
it is, yeah.
So it's a very different world than, say, Austin or Dallas.
Oh,
or San Antonio,
different.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. 5 hours away from anything.
Yeah. On a good day.
On a good day, yeah.
Yeah. It's very distinctive because of that.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, let's paint the picture of Lubbock for them.
Yeah. So what are you most proud of? What would you want to make sure that, say, a girlfriend came from your hometown mm-hmm. to visit you? Where would you take them? What would you do?
Okay, so first, I would definitely take them to Evie Mae's. It's this amazing barbecue place. And a backstory of that, of why, because if you're listening from Texas, you might think, well, Texas barbecue is everywhere. But I'm originally from Utah, Salt Lake City specifically, and there's not any barbecue places like there are in Texas in Utah. And so I would take them down there, make sure that they get the brisket, because that is the best dish that you can get there. And, you know, just experience the whole of Texas, because that in a nutshell is the Texas culture.
Specific place has become a legend in Texas, and people have come from 9 hours away.
Yeah, yeah, it's rated in the top 10. It's number 9 best barbecue place.
In all of Texas.
In all of Texas.
Yeah, I love it.
And it's a big state.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. It's definitely my favorite place, my husband's favorite place to go eat. They have barbecue lying out the door every single day, catfish on Fridays. It's awesome.
And I like their hours. It's like 11 a.m. or whatever.
Until sellout.
Which happens.
Yeah, every
day.
Oh,
it does. Mm-hmm. And it's like about maybe 3 hours later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jennifer Simonson reporting from the High Plains of West Texas in Lubbock, Texas. I'm speaking with the owner of Evie Mae's Barbecue here in Lubbock.
I'm Arnis Robbins. My wife and I own Evie Mae's Barbecue just outside of Lubbock in Wolfirth.
And how long have y'all been open?
We opened here at this brick and mortar in April of 2016, and we operated for a year prior to that out of a trailer.
And you guys go through a lot of meat in a week, don't you?
We do. Yeah, things really have kind of taken off for us, and I think we average close to 2,000 pounds a day during normal operating years.
Pre-COVID?
Pre-COVID, yes.
And how has COVID changed things for you guys?
It's definitely made things more challenging. Naturally, sales are down, the same as probably any industry right now. But we're pretty fortunate to live where we do and have a community that is so supportive of us. So even though we are down from a sales perspective, we're still hanging in. We're still getting by and doing the best we can. And unfortunately, it feels like this isn't necessarily COVID anymore. This is kind of the new norm. So the quicker we can all adjust to it and learn how to operate within these new parameters, the better we'll be. So,
how would you describe your barbecue style?
Our barbecue is very Central Texas based. And by that, I mean it's very meat forward. We always serve sauce on the side, if at all. We are really proud of our meats. It starts with a quality product, and we basically try not to screw it up through the process. It's all seasoned, very basically salt and pepper on everything, with the exception of our pork ribs, which are salt and pepper and actually finished with our sauce, which kind of cooks down and gives it kind of a more of a dry seasoning whenever it's cooked down. It's definitely not a sticky rib. But everything is very meat forward. That's something that we're very proud of.
So I grew up in Dallas, and I've lived in Central Texas for about 15 years. And it seems like barbecue has always been popular in Texas. but it's really exploded, it seems like, in the last 10 years or so. What do you attribute that to?
There's a guy, maybe you've heard of him, Aaron Franklin.
I have heard of that guy.
You know, Aaron, he was the first to take a superior product. You know, barbecue, especially Central Texas barbecue, had always been almost a byproduct of deli meats, grocery store meats that were going bad. And Aaron took a premium product, and I say premium, and a higher grade of brisket, and really babied it and tried to master cooking it in a way that very few people had ever tried, and nobody had even thought to try. I mean, the fact that he thought it could be better, not that it could just be better, but that it could actually be this premium food, mm-hmm. was amazing, that he had the foresight to realize that and then to go out and practice and try to execute it and basically prove his theory that brisket doesn't have to be this byproduct. It can be center of the plate. It can compete with an expensive steak at a steakhouse. So, you know, I think him doing that really created this new renaissance within a new generation of people. And what you see now more than ever are these first-generation barbecue people like Mallory and I. We didn't grow up a lot around it, but we were exposed to it because it became this thing that everybody wanted to pursue and everybody wanted to try this newfound cuisine that hadn't been around. I mean, not very often is there something created that nobody had ever been able to get before because nobody had ever done it before. So I think with that, people realized that it could be better, and people that had a disposition for cooking anyway, it's a very passionate food. If you're into barbecue, you know that it's passion-driven, and it's very rewarding, and it's a challenge every day. I think that's a lot of the reason that I got into it, is it's not monotonous. It's every day changes, especially out here in West Texas. The wind and rain and weather can really affect things. So it's just a very passionate food.
So for next generation Texans making barbecue, here in Lubbock, it seems like there is something interesting. There's a high school barbecue program?
That's right. There is a high school barbecue Inc. is a sanctioned Texas high school barbecue competition circuit. And many of the area high schools have now formed these barbecue competition teams, and many of them are subgroups of a culinary arts program. But yes, they have the ability to practice cooking at school. I mean, imagine going to school one day and all you've got to do today is practice cooking a brisket. But yeah, they're doing it here in Texas. So
interesting.
Let that be a testament to what barbecue means to Texans.
You know, high school football is so popular here in Texas. Do you think in about 10 years, high school brisket cooking competitions will be?
I don't think we're going to see movies being made about Texas high school barbecue, but you know, from a tradition standpoint, I would say it's just as deep rooted as football is in Texas, and it's something nice that we can all do when we're not 18 anymore and, you know, can't touch our toes.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your barbecue, and good luck to you.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
For further information, how do people find you?
We've got social media platforms on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Most of those are Evie Mays BBQ or at Evie Mays BBQ. We have a website and a mail order program at eviemaysbbq.com. And my name is Arnis Robbins.
Thank you very much. And my name is Jennifer Simonson.
The next thing that I would take them to do that I'm specifically most proud to share would be Lubbock's arts culture, because for me, that was so unexpected. When I first heard that I was moving to Lubbock, I Googled it, obviously, because I'm a millennial. So the first thing that popped up was most boring city in America. And I was like, oh my gosh, what are we getting ourselves into? But then I quickly came down here and quickly learned that the art scene, the culture, it's evolving, it's emerging, it's incredible and very unexpected.
But it is, it's a subtle, it's not a in-your-face experience.
Oh, yeah.
You do have to seek it out.
Yeah, it's a hidden gem.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite thing. I'm born and raised from Lubbock, Texas. I've been here for 25 years, and I think that's my favorite thing about Lubbock is that there are so many hidden gems. A lot of people knock on Lubbock for its size or for its location or the weather even. I don't know, I think it's fun to come here and figure out your own Lubbock, Texas for yourself. And so the art scene is incredible. Definitely has evolved since I was a little kid.
I'm Chad Plunkett. I'm the director of the Charles Adams Studio Project here in Lubbock.
Tell us a history, how this happened.
Brief history and mission is that 20 years ago, the Louise Hopkins Underwood Center was envisioned. And then our founder, Charles Adams, said, I'd like to do art stuff down there as well. And so the Underwood Center is really focused on exhibitions, and CASP is really artist-focused and provides studios for working artists.
So it really is across the whole breadth of the arts, from metal to printing. Tell us the breadth of what you do here.
Yeah, I think so. Our public studios are printmaking, so hand-pulled prints, metal fabrication, blacksmithing, foundry. The Underwood Center has a ceramic studio. But we also have live work studios and work studios, and those artists rent those studios from us and do whatever it is they do in there.
How long has the live work spaces, how long have they been going?
The live works have been open since 2011. The work studios are 2016, and then we just opened four new ones in 2018.
So looking forward, future vision, growth, say 10 years from now,
yeah,
how different will it be?
Well, the next set of four studios we want to build are going to be just live studios. So what we want to be able to do is better provide opportunities for writers, poets, playwrights, musicians that don't need a big exhibition space, but really just would like to live down here. And so that's my next set of four that I'm currently fundraising for. And then after that, we'll go back to the work studios, which are really just an empty room that the artist does whatever it is they do.
If you erase Texas Tech University, mm-hmm, say it was not here, what would the momentum of the arts be like here? In other words, how central is that to this?
I think they're certainly connected, and Texas Tech, I mean, Lubbock without Texas Tech is not what it is today. Mm-hmm. We would probably still be a hub of sorts. But, you know, in 1923, I think Plainview was actually bigger. Now, Lubbock also is a medical hub for our region. And so that's just kind of, that's a bit of an impossible question. But, you know, this.
But it is interesting because of that amorphousness, mm-hmm, of why a place like Lubbock becomes an art center.
Well, and Texas Tech's had an art department, mm-hmm, since the 1940s or something. I mean, they've always had that a part of their program in the College of Human Sciences, and then now they're their own department. And so you get a big international community, a much more eclectic community than sort of, for how isolated we are, we have people from all over.
Even though right now we're still in the midst of the COVID world, you're still going. Tell us about how it shifted and how things were.
Well, the biggest thing that happened is a lot of the big public things we do, we're just not able to do. But in terms of our artists, they're still in their studios making work.
You're able to interact with the public to a certain level.
We're doing some virtual things. The Underwood Center has a virtual film festival going on. We're planning what is our CASP Fest, which is an exhibition, music, film, poetry. And so some of that stuff for us is going to be in person, and some of it's going to be online.
Okay, a little bit about you. How did you come to be the director?
I became the director of the Charles Adams Studio Project because I'm a failed sculptor. I wanted to be a famous artist, and I am not. But I guess one of the things that I am good at is organizing things. I do think I'm a good conduit between foundations and donors and grant writing and artists. So from day-to-day operations to long-term vision, I think I play my role okay.
But you are still an artist, and you...
I still make work. I'm in the studio, sometimes late at night, call it third shift at times. So when my boys go to bed, sometimes I sneak back up here and make something.
So is metal your favorite form?
Metal fabrication is what I do the most of. I really love wood. Wood has become kind of challenging time-wise for me, and so metal fab is what I've done the most of. I mean, really in the last 10 years. I guess the biggest thing I miss with COVID is our number one event was the First Friday Art Trail. I mean, literally 5,000 people would descend upon these city blocks, closing the streets, food trucks, live music, art, hanging out with friends, high-fiving people. So I can't wait till we get back to that. I think Lubbock is great because we are isolated, and I love the challenge of that. Nobody's going to baby you here. You got to be tough to survive out here. It's hot, and then it's cold, and the wind blows. But there's also a freedom out here. I'm in downtown Lubbock. In 5 minutes, I could be in the middle of a cotton field, and I love that.
Yeah. How far to drive to Austin or Houston or Dallas?
Austin is 5.5. Dallas, depending upon traffic, once you hit Fort Worth, is 5 to 6, maybe 7. If I go to Houston, once again, I mean, you're probably looking at 9 hours to
wow.
Houston. A lot of Lubbock people actually vacation really probably in New Mexico. We're only like 4.5 hours from Santa Fe. So the mountains there, a lot of Lubbock people probably have cabins in Ruidosa, Cloudcroft.
Interesting.
And we have a lot of Lubbock folk that head up to Colorado because 9 hours you're in Trinidad.
So you're really basically a day's drive to anywhere for the most part.
We say we're in the center of everything. It just takes you a day to get to the next spot.
I love it. If somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
Our website is casp-arts.org. We're also active on social media at, you can type in Charles Adams Studio Project in your Facebook, or follow us on Instagram at casp_LBK. And my name is Chad Plunkett.
Thank you so much.
The wine scene, as I've gotten older, I have loved enjoying Texas wine, especially High Plains wine. And it's fun to go on to Berkeley Hill Winery in downtown Lubbock and enjoy a glass of wine that was grown, produced, and bottled all in Lubbock, Texas. So,
and it really is literally the premier wine grape growing region of all Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Not kind of, sort of.
Right, exactly. And I think people are just stunned by that fact. Mm. And it's crazy when they do pop a bottle of wine that is from Lubbock, they're like, okay, wait, this is really good, you know? So it's fun.
Impressive, and it's not that old of a wine grape growing region. It's what, last 30 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy that it's that young, but we do produce 90% of Texas wine grapes. That's just incredible to me.
So here we are in Lubbock, Texas, down in the basement of an old Crest department store. And it's now a winery, or actually a processing of grapes, down here in the basement, downtown Lubbock. This is cool. Tell us the story.
My name is Ben Hernandez.
My name is Chase Hill. My family has been farming for nearly 100 years on land out west of Lubbock. I don't know, I guess 2002 or so, we decided to plant some grapes.
So were you cotton before that? Or what?
Yeah, cotton, sorghum, corn, peanuts, just anything, soybeans even, just anything that would grow in our area, we've grown.
So why did you guys decide to try grapes?
We've always looked for alternative crops, and that's kind of what led us down this path. A good friend of ours, who he wasn't a friend at the time, but he's a friend now, Neil Newsom, he kind of talked us into it. He's got a vineyard over there. He's one of the oldest growers in the state. He has a couple hundred acres, and he does a really good job of it. He said, hey, this looks like a great location for grapes. Next thing you know, we're planting grapes. Mm-hmm. So.
But it wasn't to sell to Newsom.
No, it wasn't. So for the most part, up until recently, like all the fruit that we grew, we would sell to other wineries, and they've gone all over the state.
But now you're doing your own in-house label production, right?
Yes, we are. Yes.
And the great wine label is called?
Berkeley Hill Vineyards.
And what do you specialize in? What are you known for? What are you most proud of?
Probably our Malbec. Malbec grows really well here, and we've made some really good Malbecs in the past. We had one in 2015 vintage that won double gold in San Francisco.
At the Chronicle?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then we've had a different vintage, not that vintage, but we had another one that placed gold at Texom, which Texom is another really good high-end wine competition that happens here in the U.S.
That's in Houston? Or
I think it's in Dallas, right?
Dallas, okay.
Yeah, Dallas.
Mm-hmm. So we have a sommelier here?
We sure do.
Yeah.
My name is Ben Hernandez, and I'm the sommelier and wine director here for Berkeley Hill Vineyards.
Awesome. And talk to us about your background. How did you first get into wine, and how did it get you?
Yeah, for sure. So wine really, I grew up in this area in Lubbock, but I had no idea that we were producing grapes of quality out here. It wasn't until college that
did
I sort
you
of
go to Texas Tech?
Oh, no, I did not go to Texas Tech. I went to Cornell University.
Oh.
And one of my professors up there in the hotel management school did her graduate work here at Tech, and she was really the one that sort of introduced me to what wines can be, especially from Texas. Surprisingly, Texas isn't one of those states that's covered in wine knowledge classes. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, Texas grows grapes, but there's that's the extent of what you get. Most most everyone talks about California. So as soon as I heard that our region was one of the hot spots for things coming up, I was like, well, maybe I should go home and figure out what's happening down there. So I finished up there in New York, came back over here, and was really looking for my footing in the wine industry. And I was lucky enough to sort of encounter Chase and Elizabeth Hill, the owners of Berkeley Hill. At the time, they were just starting up and had just purchased out their partners from the previous winery. So they were really looking for just fresh faces, new people. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of their startup, and I was lucky enough to get in on that.
So the Berkeley Hill has a winery, and it's processing in the basement downtown, but you guys also have a restaurant right downtown, correct?
Yes, we do.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, for sure. So the it's one of those natural combinations. People think, you know, food, they should also think wine. In the American cuisine, we really haven't embraced that so much. The Europeans have done it for centuries, and Americans are still a little slow in that respect, gaining that wine is part of food. But for us, it was a very natural, complementary action. So we thought, you know, we've got a winery, why not go ahead and introduce food, and especially West Texas food, West Texas style food, with the great wines that we're growing out here. So Chase was really a really big proponent of making sure that happened and things were going in the direction that we needed to. But we also wanted to make sure that we were offering things of quality at the same time. So you find in our menu, we've got, you know, something that's called the Dolly, which has candied jalapenos on it and, you know, those prime Southwestern type flavors. But then we also do use truffle oil and mushrooms and arugula, which a lot of people don't eat out here in the South. So we've got a good mixture of things that are happening for us.
What other raw ingredients are you able to source here locally and regionally?
Yeah, so that's a little more difficult. Our growing season here, I mean, it's long and it's good, but there's not a lot of greenhouses to get produce year-round.
I saw a few hoop greenhouses.
Yeah, there's a few, and most of them around here are used for research.
Oh, got it.
So I do have a friend. I actually met him at Tech whenever I was there, and we've been getting some of our produce from him, what he can supply. And then we just introduced a new pizza with short ribs on it, and he has a herd of organically grown, hormone-free, and we're using short ribs from him for that. But yeah, like we try hard to do what we can to use local products.
Back to your world, because you kind of bridge both, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
The culinary, and you're out probably on a tractor at times.
Yeah, it happens, yeah.
So talk to us about, again, the Lubbock up here on
the High Plains.
The High Plains, yeah. That it's a very distinctive growing region, and it's a premier one for the whole state of Texas that I think a lot of people do not understand. And don't get me wrong, I love Fredericksburg and the whole Hill Country, but I think there are a lot of people by default that think that they grow some of the premium grapes of Texas. And not necessarily so.
That is correct. And don't get me wrong, the Hill Country does grow some great grapes.
Yeah,
but
they do. Yeah.
The quantity that they need to supply the tasting rooms they have down there on 290, they can't do it down there.
Somebody said part of it is just economics. The cost of land to grow grapes
completely, yes.
is a deal breaker for them. So if they had available affordable land, they could expand immensely.
Yeah, to expand, No, and up here, land is like everywhere.
So it's,
you know what I mean, it's,
so part of
it's
the,
wide open. So.
Again, part of the ingredient outside of the environment is economics, plain and simple, correct?
Yes, correct.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And most of the guys up here, all the guys that are growing grapes now are farmers. I mean, they've grown thousands of acres of cotton before. They know how to manage it. They know how to work the land. They know how to manage the water. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just kind of a natural fit for the production side of it to be up here. So.
A little less risky with market forces, a little more constant price.
Yeah, so it is a constant price, but again, weather is a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, weather's always a problem for a farmer. It's never good. Problem we've seen the last few years, so many farmers have converted over to growing some grapes, and so many acres have gone in that they're, like last year, I had a hard time selling all the fruit that came off the vineyard.
Oh, so overproduction.
Yeah, so overproduction. And it's not necessarily, and it's not that the tasting rooms or the wineries can't handle the fruit. It's just that the infrastructure's not there yet.
Got it.
So, like, what we need is, like, you drive through California, you see big tank farms. That's what we need up here. That would help the industry as a whole, because then you have years like this year where the crop is short, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have a way to bridge the 2019s and the 2020s.
Right.
So you can use your leftover fruit from 19 to go ahead and have enough to sell for 2020 when your fruit's short. it. So,
interesting.
Yeah, and it's all going to happen. It just takes time and money.
So it's a young industry up here. It is.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is.
So you guys are finding your way.
Yeah, we're trying. We're trying our hardest.
How would you describe the outstanding varietals from Lubbock, from up here?
Yeah, for sure. So our varietals that we mostly grow are going to be Italian, Southern French, Spanish, a few Greek, but few and far between. And that's just going to be your Muscats, basically. We specialize in red wines because we are a hot climate down here. But because we have those huge diurnal temperature swings and continentality, we can actually make sure that they have enough acid. Whereas some of Europe, you know, in the Mediterranean is just hot all the time.
Right, right.
We get those Canadian winds down here that really help us out. So we have outstanding varietals like, you know, our Malbec that we do really well with. But Merlot and Cab Sauv are two other ones that do well.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah, I was talking to a grower the other day up here, and it's interesting because there are some parallels between your environmental influences, the diurnal shift, for example, and the coastal region of California.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the coastal region of California really benefits from those sea winds that sort of cool everything down and get hot in the evening. And really the mountain ridges also help with that as well because they bring in mist that help cool down the entire atmosphere. For us, it's just, you know, glacial winds that come straight from Canada. And since there's no mountains in the way, we get a lot of cold air, especially in the winter.
That's interesting.
So it really, we have a lot of air movement here. Mm-hmm. That helps us in the same way that the sea helps California.
What are you most proud of?
Being part of people's everyday, even though they don't see us as involved as we'd like to be. You know, having a bottle of wine from your region, from your state, from your area, and being able to impact everyone's everyday life at their dinner table without them knowing and just having that small hand. Because a lot of times, you know, culinarily, you're looking at whoever is producing the food immediately in front of you, but you don't really think about the beverage that's there, and that's us.
So you're really an educator, aren't you?
Yeah,
a big-time educator. Because there are a lot of people that are Lubbockites, or whatever you guys are called, that don't get out that much.
Yeah.
You know, that, so this is the going to the big city.
Yeah, so we're a little bit insular out here. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to have them come down and figure out that we can do much more than, you know, just cotton and peanuts over here. And we are growing grapes and doing a good job at it.
Final thought?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed the winemaking side of this. Like, that's where building the vineyards was fun. Like, I enjoy building things, and that's something that I got to do, build trellis, build irrigation systems, all that kind of thing. And now we're to the point where I'm ready to do something else. Like, I still enjoy being in the field and driving the tractor and all that, but it's not my passion anymore. And I think really moving into the winemaking side of it is what I want to do. Like, that's where I want to go. So,
cool.
And there's very few people that actually have control over their vines and their wines. So that's something that I really want to do, is be able to control both.
Which is really cool because you know the product, what you have coming in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's really cool. If somebody wanted to learn more about Berkeley Hills and Lubbock.
Yeah, for sure. So you would visit us at our website. That's www.berkeleyhillvineyards.com. We do have an active Facebook page, Instagram, and Twitter. So you can find us all at our handle at Berkeley Hill.
BerkeleyHillVineyards.com. And my name is Chase Hill.
And my name is Ben Hernandez. Wine and Spirit Education Trust, Level 3.
So there's more.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we've been blown away in the last 3 days just eating, going to some of the restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
That are true gourmet, crazy gourmet.
They are so gourmet, international even. We have chefs from all across the city that have trained internationally, have trained at these highly acclaimed institutions, and they choose to come back to Lubbock, and they choose to open up these high-end but also affordable restaurants, and it's a really great thing that they choose to come back and share this with their community.
Do you think the locals realize and appreciate how cool their culinary scene really is, or do you think they take it for granted to a point?
I think that they appreciate it.
I do too. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of incredible places to eat, and I think that I think the locals realize that.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that it's very obvious in what Lubbockites do for their choice of nightlife. We have a revitalized downtown. We're in the middle of a revitalization, and it is being built on these amazing restaurants, on just the dining scene downtown. So I would say that by the choice of what Lubbockites like to do, we totally appreciate it.
Eat and drink. That's what we like.
Well, and one more. And granted, it's kind of at no reality counts today because of COVID. But under normal scenario, last time I came here, a couple, 3 years ago, I was told that there were more live music venues in Lubbock than in Austin, Texas.
Per capita.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think growing up here, I've really been able to see that, you know, from being a child and my parents taking me to live concerts, you know, at the amphitheaters or downtown or, you know, whatever. I grew up around live music. And in Buddy Holly, I think that was such a big impact on Lubbock and our music scene. And I just think that he truly left a legacy here that people hold on to.
Tell people about Buddy Holly and his connection with Lubbock.
Yeah, Buddy Holly went to Lubbock High School. He was born and raised in Lubbock, Texas, and really created a name for himself during his short life. He, I think he died at 22.
Yeah.
He was in a plane crash with Ricky Valens in the Big Bopper, if I remember correctly, and it's really unfortunate how he passed away, but he inspired artists like the Beatles. You know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets. The Beatles would have never been the Beatles if it wasn't for Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
That's my favorite story.
I think that's so cool. Being a big Beatles fan myself, and I don't know, I think that before I worked at Visit Lubbock, Buddy Holly's name was, you know, maybe a street address or just a character, but the more I've gotten, you know, into Lubbock culture and understood our history, he has played such a big part, and especially in the music scene.
And today, his name is growing, because you're finishing right now as we speak the Buddy Holly perform.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. It's going to open up such a stage for Lubbock to have Broadway performances, a live music, you know, venue. It's state of the art NC15 theater. It's an incredible place. And if you ever get the chance to come to Lubbock, you have to catch a show here for
sure.
Yeah.
It's a must.
Mind blowing. We took a tour of a hard hat tour. What is it? 2,200 seats in the main auditorium itself. That's incredible.
Yeah, world class for sure.
My favorite thing is when the director of the Lubbock Entertainment Performing Arts Alliance, he says, his name is Tim Collins, he says that Buddy Holly's legacy is so intertwined in Lubbock that they're really hoping that by building the Buddy Holly Hall that we'll be able to find the next Buddy Holly, that the resources provided will produce the next.
Absolutely. Yeah.
My name is Tim Collins and I'm the board chairman for LEPA.
The world of Buddy Holly in Lubbock, Texas. And you guys are taking it to the next level right now.
We certainly think so. Yeah. Buddy Holly was a great influence, known all over the world for his music and the changes he brought about in the music industry. And for us to have an opportunity to honor him in our city and yet hopefully bring about the next great musician, the next change in the industry, and accommodate that person's important.
And the formal name of the music center, because it's more than just music.
It is. Yeah. It's called the Buddy Holly Hall of Performing Arts and Sciences.
There you go, sciences.
And sciences. And there is a lot of science involved in that. I was surprised, quite frankly, between acoustics and engineering that's involved.
But even end use, how you're going to use the structure for students and whatnot.
Exactly. This has
kind of
become
bridges over to the sciences.
This has become an educational campus in addition to a performance center. We feel like we're going to be very accommodating to our K-12 students who are partners in our building in helping them develop hopefully a career path that may be different from the norm, but something that they were interested in and allow them to do something maybe outside the box.
And to put it in perspective, this is the main theater venue is 2,200 seats, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. And you have other venues, 400 seats and whatnot.
Right.
So it's a large facility, multi-purpose, multi-dimensional in the city of Lubbock. That must have been daunting and scary to a point, the project that you guys agreed to take on. Share with us ways you found ways to pull it off.
We knew in our community that a building like this would need to be privately funded. And of course, we were starting in 2011, 2012, and coming off of the Great Recession of 2008, you know, people were very conscious about how their tax dollars were being spent. And so we have raised this money privately to build this building and then created accommodations inside to allow for partnerships that'll help us to be sustainable.
So no tax burden on the citizens?
None at all.
That's pretty cool.
The city of Lubbock, let me mention, the city of Lubbock did donate the land that we're sitting on. This was a residential neighborhood that had been virtually wiped out in the tornado of 1970. Mm-hmm. The Department of Public Safety built their licensing office here, and then they moved in 2012, and so the city allowed us to use this piece of property.
That's really cool. You're not that far from completion.
Oh, we're just a couple of months away.
It's palpable. I mean, they're putting the finishing touches over there.
Yeah, you're seeing paint, the last stage of painting, mm-hmm. the last stage of flooring and things like that being done. Yeah. The major crafts are nearing completion. So, yeah, we can start to taste it. You're right.
But it's an interesting time for you. We are still in the midst of the COVID unknown. And so going forward, the blessing is probably you're under less pressure than you would have been if there wasn't a COVID. Because you would have some major event lined up to be your grand opening, mm-hmm. and it might be a soft opening.
No doubt about it. We're going to have some soft opening types of events going forward, and they're going to be local musicians between our symphony and our ballet and individual performers that will come and play here. And yeah, maybe there is a little less pressure on that. Mm-hmm. It's always good to practice.
Yeah,
and so we'll get to practice operationally how the building's going to work before we have you know, the major names come to town. But we've got lots of major names that want to be a part of this building.
That's cool. And tell us how you made the whole major venue more viable for your educational system here.
The story was that we recognized and were told by a variety of consultants that buildings like this do not operate in the black. Being privately funded, we had to operate in the black. And so we took on partners in the building. The ballet company, the local ballet school, became a partner. They'll be a tenant in the building. We brought in a restaurant operator to operate a restaurant and concessions and catering in the building. And then finally, our local independent school district came on as a partner. They are a tenant in this space. And so we built some things to accommodate them, a small theater that seats 425 and about 6,000 feet of multi-purpose space added as well. So we could very easily become the UIL competition capital of the state of Texas, without a doubt.
And you have Texas Tech right here.
Yes.
In what ways are they going to benefit?
So Texas Tech being here, they will utilize this space to add to their performance opportunities. As a matter of fact, there's a team from the Texas Tech School of Music walking through the building today, mm-hmm. looking at how they can utilize our space to add to their teaching capacity.
What's their largest on-campus venue for performance?
About 600 seats in the Allen Theater.
So they're probably loving this.
They're really excited about having the opportunity to use these various spaces that we have in the building. And of course, we're excited about that, too. How do you best encourage the K through 12 students? By having these tech students in the building and showing them. Our Broadway partner, ATG out of Kansas, is a nonprofit, and they take the profits from a community performance. When Les Mis comes here, all the profits that are generated from that performance remain in Lubbock for educational purposes.
That's really
cool.
And
so that is really going to be great.
That's a double win.
It is a win, and it gives us a chance, I think, with because of their relationship, those performers that are stagehands and et cetera will be here mm-hmm. and be open to speaking to and visiting with our classes to come in and to share what their work life is like.
So your performa is, in the most conservative perspective, shows that it's a viable net zero operation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then the one thing you talk a little bit more about, you have the grocery corp that's connected here with Lubbock, and they've come in. How are they?
Yeah, so United Supermarkets was a family-owned chain of grocery stores. They sold 3 or 4 years ago to the Albertsons Group. But being family-owned and being centered in Lubbock, they have been great supporters of our community for a long time. And so United Supermarkets is going to operate our restaurant, our concessions, and our catering.
How does that work? You don't just give them the venue, right?
No, they pay rent. They pay rent. Actually, we have a profit sharing and rent agreement.
That's what I was going to ask about. So some of the money, it benefits you guys.
Absolutely, yes. I think it benefits the corporation, but it benefits us as well. Mm-hmm. And again, we talked, you know, earlier in our tour about downtown revitalization and the need for downtown dining experiences. And so this is going to be a great help for that too.
And so you were talking about you have a little dining venue where you can come and eat before the concert, right?
Sure, yeah. So we've got a 100-seat restaurant and with some outdoor dining. And then we have space in the building that would accommodate a pre-function meal. Mm-hmm. So whether you had a catered event before a show or you just bought a ticket online and said, I want 2 tickets for Lion King and 2 steak dinners and a bottle of wine beforehand, you can do all of that and have that in the building. So it'll be a full evening experience for some of our patrons.
That's really cool. And then once again, a game changer for the people in the community of Lubbock.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lubbock is a regional hub. We are pretty used to driving here in West Texas. And so we will attract visitors from 100-150-mile radius.
Or more.
Because
everybody has to drive 150 miles.
You have to drive 150 miles to get anywhere in West Texas. Yeah. But our friends from Amarillo or Midland, Odessa, mm-hmm. Eastern New Mexico, they come to Lubbock for Texas Tech events. Mm-hmm. They come to Lubbock to shop. They come to Lubbock for all types of entertainment. And so this would just be another component to having people come into the city.
That's really cool. And even though Texas is so monstrously huge, you're not that far from New Mexico.
No, 90 miles to New Mexico. Yeah, we have great partners in eastern New Mexico to the building mm-hmm. and to our community.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, to learn more about the Buddy Holly Center,
LEPA.org, LEPAA.org, or give us a call. We'd love to tell you more about the opportunities that we have here. My name is Tim Collins, and I'm the board chairman for LEPA. I appreciate you being here.
Tim, my pleasure.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
Okay, we're about out of time, but before we go, a couple more cool secrets of Lubbock that things people might not imagine.
I said it earlier, Lubbock is so unexpected. You might not think of Lubbock first when you think of going to a very cultural, a very social place. But when you come here, you will be pleasantly surprised, because you did touch on our music scene. We have live music every single night somewhere in the city, multiple places. And so I would say you'll be very, very pleasantly surprised.
Well, I have a pleasant surprise today. I don't know if you heard, I dropped my wallet in front of the coffee house this morning. On the street, on the sidewalk.
Yeah, they called him and they said, hey, we got your wallet.
Yeah, so a neighboring business guy called up. He says, I found your wallet. If you want it back, come. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
It is, and I think that really embodies the culture of West Texas and Lubbock, Texas, you know, specifically, because we are just the friendliest city in America is what people say, and it's true that we look out for each other, and there's a lot of love in this city, for sure.
That's really cool. Okay, to learn more, one, like a website, and then social media.
That's yes, right. So our website is visitlubbock.org.
Yep, and you can follow me on social media, or me, Visit Lubbock on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, all Visit Lubbock. So.
Excellent, that's easy.
Thank you so much.
All right, and one more time.
I'm McKenna Dowdle.
And I'm Lacey Freeland.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Lubbock, Texas. We'll see you here.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
That'll be the day.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Tell me maybe that someday will I be true. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry.